Hey guys, welcome back. We're the Story Crafters. I'm Jeff. We have Jared, Nicole, and Charlie together. Again, we are the Story Crafters. Welcome back. If this is you're tuning in for the second time, last time we learned a little bit about us, who we are, what we like to do, D&D-wise, hobby-wise, and we talked about our downtime at the table. Hopefully you got some enjoyment out of that. Today, though, we're just going to jump right into it. This is episode two. So we're going to go ahead and, guys, let's roll initiative.
All right.
Okay.
I had a 16.
Six better than last time.
Yeah. I got a 13.
Oh, man.
Hey, Nicole's leading. What'd you get?
My dice was on an 18, and it just teetered right over to a 4. So
no.
So it's always at least some things don't change.
Then, all right, Nicole, you are leading the charge here.
All right. Go ahead. What I've been up to the last week or so, I got back into our family D&D campaign, which was really exciting. We took about, about a 2-month hiatus on accident because Mama got very busy. But we did a adventure from the kids' table. It's called 15-Minute D&D. This is actually the second story adventure package that they put out that's in this series, 15-Minute D&D. It's called Undersea Adventure, and it is about mermaids, which my 5-year-old daughter was super excited about. It's a really nice kid-friendly or beginner D&D adventure. We had a ton of fun with it. The way it works is it's in 5 little mini adventure sections that all go together. And we got through like 2.5 of them. So we're about halfway through the undersea adventure. One of the unlikely chaotic highlights of our gameplay was that the DM, playing as the NPC of the prince, the mermaid prince, Prince Eric, got into a very heated argument with my daughter's character because she absolutely would not believe that he was the real prince of the mer people. She was convinced, like, this is fake. You are not the real Prince Eric. You are not him.
You're an literally.
Yeah. Yes. So it was just a very lengthy argument of me as him trying to convince her, like, how can I make you believe that I am the real Prince Eric? Eventually, we settled it with a pinky promise. So it worked out.
When all else fails.
But yeah, that was super fun. Super great adventure. Definitely recommend it for families out there or for people who are new to D&D looking for something simple and like quick setup, ready to go within, 5-10 minutes. You just got to read through a few pages of a PDF. And I'll definitely include it in the show notes, but you can get the Undersea Adventure from the kids table on itch.io, whatever that is, for $2.99. Less than $3. You and your family can play too. That's super
cool. There you go. Okay.
That sounds really fun. I would love to have an argument with my son over if Prince Eric is real or not. That sounds so much fun. Oh, man. I can't wait to get Eli involved with D&D.
Homie's time.
Man. After you, I think, was me, I think. I had a 13. This past week I actually got a new game room that took up the majority of my time. Because my son has outgrown his old room, which is now the game room. And he asked me multiple times to move rooms. So that was where most of my time went, hobby related, was building this new room again. But I did get some, I got a one shot listed, for Rogue Game Masters, that's happening locally here in Virginia Beach. Actually, it's going to be in Chesapeake over at a garage brewery. So that's happening on January 12th. So that will be a lot of my time. We'll be prepping for that. Really just kind of cracked open some merfolk prints. By crack open, I mean 3D printed some merfolk prints that my players will run into here. Hopefully in the next session or two, we'll find out. So, yeah.
I'm starting to see a theme here. Charlie, if you don't say something about mermaids, I'm going to be upset.
Okay, I got it. Ruth, I'm next, right? Because you had a 3?
Yeah. I think it was a 4, but...
Just kidding. Fair enough. Well, I only got a 5, so I'm just a hair faster. Big thing this week has been getting all that Black Friday sales that I scored. Got a couple sweet things for those that are watching the live recording. Found my local game store, Tower of Games, these just gnarly what would you call it? Like Cthulhu Abomination kind of things. So I found a bunch of those, which are going to be great for part of my campaign that is going to be coming up for one of my groups. Won't say which, in case they're listening. Probably in about they listen. Yeah. But this is the big one that is just sick. Wicked. It's like these roots, but like tentacles at the same time. Very, very sinister. The other thing, speak to pull back into the merfolk thing, I also got... did some Black Friday shopping with a Critical Role and got one of their mini sets, including this and a variety of others, which did include the Warlock of Uketoa and a Sea Fury. So there we go.
Oh, cool.
trying to pull that in. Very excited about that. Got some great minis for a steal, including just a friendly tip for everyone listening. Go to your local game store. Keep an eye out on anything in clearance. And remember, your minis that you use for your games do not always have to be from the same franchise. And they don't have to always be scaled the same either. I just recently scored... And apologies for anyone that is a big fan. There's a tabletop game based on George R. R. Martin books, various different ones. And they have these sets. But I'll pull one up right here. But they are basically box sets of like 13 different minis that, you know, serve some kind of focus for some kind of tabletop game and everything. But here they are, and they're all really sturdy, really nice quality. But the box itself, I was able to get 75% off. So a $40 box of 13 minis was now 10. And, that is a steal. So I'm very excited. That's going to be part of what I bring for my professional games from place to place, because they're a lot sturdier than some of my painted minis. And, they'll look really nice to just plop down and those be, you know, some of the enemies and stuff to go up against. So
I'm a big fan of like filching minis and accessories from other games.
It's crazy how sometimes, you know, craft stores or, you know, lesser known licensed games, you can get basically the same mini, like of a horse, right? That like pre-painted, you know, from somewhere well-known would be like $15, but you could get for $1 at some other places, and they're still pretty much same to scale. So
I do that all the time in my games, just proxy other things, especially like because Charlie, that used section of Tower, just sometimes it is just so good. And I did the same thing with Black Friday. I was very heavily checking out their stuff there.
So I think all in all this past week, I ordered maybe about $120, bought and ordered $120 worth of Black Friday deals, and had to reorganize basically all of my mini storage because I think when I last counted, I ended up adding about 60 minis. So
that's a lot of minis.
And they're not all just like, you know, medium to, you know, small minis. I mean, like sets like this, this is large for sure, as well as this. And one of them's painted, the other one's nicely private detail. So, I mean, an average of all of them, $2 each, it was a hell of a score this year. So
yeah,
always be on the up.
My pile of potential is far too grand.
Pile of gray shame.
It's potentials. Yeah. Yeah.
Pile of gray shame. Hey, most of my stuff is at least primed. I think I have a problem. I may need a diagnosis where I can't play games with unpainted minis. Some of my paint jobs are so bad that I was just like, I had to get it on the table.
Nothing wrong. It works. Nope. Nothing wrong with that at all. So this last week it was session 29, I believe, of the homebrew world that I DM. And it was like the most prep I think I've ever done for a session. It was like a huge culmination of literally months and dozens of sessions, you know, not dozens, but probably close to 15 to 18 sessions, all like culminated in one. My players were returning to the largest city that they visited, at least in this world. And it was under siege from an evil pirate tyrant who was after an artifact in the city that the players actually had on them. They were able to get to the bay, get to their ship, and able to escape. But it was one of those things that I wish I would have recorded it because there were so many great moments that we actually had very little combat. We did kind of, I DM'd it almost like a fog of war thing because there was so much going on. There were so many moving parts that I really just zoomed in on, you're on this street. This is what's happening on this street. You know, yeah, there's cannon fire raining down on the city. Half the city's ablaze. There's factions of guards who have, you know, are turncoats now who are fighting other guards. There's pirates looting and raiding, nice. All these things. So it was chaos, which is why I think I overprepped. And then I actually had to get to the point where I like cut myself off. I'm like, no, I'm going to zoom back out. And I'm just going to have like bullet points in my notes and I'll just fill in. And it was, I think, the most fun I've ever had DMing a session. It was incredible. The players were awesome. The role play was awesome. It was truly one of the best things I've been a part of. And all credit goes to my players, because without them being able to navigate it and making the choices they did, we never would have gotten from point A to point B, let alone all the way through. So it was fantastic. It was truly awesome.
Oh, that's epic.
Gosh. Yeah, man.
Love those good sessions where you end, like you go and you plan so much for days and then you just, you know, screw it, we'll do it live, and you two or three bullet points and let the players carry the rest. That really, man, there's nothing quite like it.
I think there's a time and a place for both, because there are some times that you really have to, mm-hmm. not even over prep, you really have to, I'm always a fan of thoroughly prepping, but you always want to leave it open. And sometimes I think for me, when I prep too much, I'm running the risk of railroading the players.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, there was endless possibilities and options. I knew they wanted to get from where they are to their ship and escape, but they could have taken any route. So I found it was great just to like, I'm going to plan. These things are happening in these sections of the city and, you know, they may never come to fruition, but it was perfectly fine. And it was great. It turned out great. So
there you go.
Love that. That'd be a good thing too, if it's not already on the D100 table, add that on, over prepping versus under prepping.
Oh, it is. It's all
maybe there. We can. Yeah. There we go. Okay. Great. Good. Y'all had some productive weeks with some things, and gosh, super fun. I'm hoping to have a good time. I'm actually on vacation right now. I started vacation yesterday until January 2nd. So.
For you,
hopefully I'll get some good hobby in. So I've got I'm starting a new sci-fi project with a friend of mine that we got to craft some sci-fi terrain. So it's very out of my element
I don't normally do sci-fi things, so that'll be fun.
Sounds awesome. I'm excited to see what you come up with.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. But enough about what I am going to do and what we are going to do. What we are going to do right now, we're going to transition in, and Charlie is going to talk to us. Or who's handling the lore today?
I think I get the privilege of doing that today, if you'll allow it.
I think so. I think I'll allow it. All right. We're going to jump into the lore. We'll be back in a second.
I hate the way that sounded. All right, welcome back, guys. We're the Story Crafters. We're about to jump into our lore section here. Jared, take it away, bud.
All right, this one's a bit of a deep cut. So I was trying to decide what I wanted to focus in on here. And so I just looked at a map of the Forgotten Realms, of the Sword Coast specifically. So I found a little string of islands called the Purple Rocks. Does anybody know about the Purple Rocks? Because I did not, even a tiny bit. It ended up tying beautifully into my homebrew world, which I thought was kind of fun. So the Purple Rocks, they are a secluded archipelago located west of Gunderland in the Trackless Sea. They are approximately 500 miles due west of Waterdeep. While they appear as barren rocky outcroppings from afar, closer inspection reveals verdant valleys sheltered behind sparse forested peaks. The island's most striking feature is the vibrant violet lichens and mosses that grow across the rocky surfaces, giving them their distinctive purplish hue, particularly under stormy skies. The archipelago consists of two primary islands, Trisk to the west and Eutheral to the east. They are surrounded by numerous smaller uncharted islets. These islands endure some of the harshest conditions in the Trackless Sea, along with winters spanning nearly 8 months. Sounds lovely. The constant icy winds known as Oral's Breath freeze everything exposed, while dense fog often cloaks the islands during the short thaw. Summers are cool, with temperatures resembling sub-Arctic climates. It's just kind of piggybacking off of what we talked about in the last episode with Icewind Dale.
Yeah.
The inhabitants are the Rocklanders. They are descendants of Northlander settlers from Gundarlun. They live in tight-knit, isolated communities, relying on fishing, farming, and trade to survive. Magic is strictly forbidden, and its use is punishable by death, which I think just makes for such a cool setting to build off in a world. While the Rocklanders outwardly worship Tempest, the barbaric god of war, Oral, the Frost Maiden, and Umberly, the storm goddess of the seas, their idols of these deities are notably adorned with tentacle-like appendages, hinting at an underlying influence. By the late 15th century DR, which I learned this morning, that DR stands for Dale Reckoning, the Rocklanders had fallen under the dominion of the Kraken, Slarkrethel, who used the islands as a base for his Kraken Society spy network, which I just love in the lore of D&D, that we have all these fancy mythical names, and then we just have something called the Kraken Society spy network. That stands out to me, but that is that's the name. On the island Trisk, which is the western island, is home to the capital, Ulf of Thugr, a struggling fishing and farming settlement. Its people augment their resources through piracy and serve as agents of the Kraken Society, recording intelligence that flows into the island. The other island, Eutheral, is the eastern island that boasts richer fishing waters and the throne of the city Vilkstead. It is known for its exports of preserved fish and the pungent goat cheese, Vilksmarg, which is sought after across the Sword Coast.
Wow, okay.
Mm. Which I think is fun, because you can take something like that cheese Vilksmarg and, you know, drop that into a tavern anywhere. And, you know, if you talk about it, an NPC could bring it up and they're like, well, where's that from, you know? And then you have
that dialogue. Let me tell you.
Exactly. A couple other quick notes on it. Off the coast, off the coast of Trisk lies an ancient sunken city named Askarlay. I believe I'm saying that correct. I looked so many places and there was very few references for it. But it's a massive underwater elven city that was destroyed by the drow. And it now serves as the lair of a kraken and the hub for the kraken society. There's also a flame home isle in the archipelago. And it is claimed by the dragon Galaderos, which is a adult copper dragon.
Oh, yes. Nice.
It refers to one of the islands as its home, but its exact location remains unknown. And that dragon was tied to many adventures, and I think loosely ties into Storm King's Thunder, though I'm not as familiar with that adventure. But that is the Purple Rocks in a nutshell.
Wow, I
really cool.
It's really cool. I've not heard of it, but I've heard, Storm King's Thunder, Waterdeep, like that. That is really cool. What a neat little spot.
Man.
To me, it's fun. These are the kind of places that I look for when I am starting a homebrew world, because there's enough lore and history there. And it's set in a massive world, but it's still isolated enough that you can drop your adventurers here. And you have plenty of sessions just within this world, within these islands. But then if they want to explore beyond, well, then, hey, you have the whole world and we already have these ties, like with the goat cheese, obviously that implies if it's all along the Sword Coast, there's ships coming in and out. Maybe they hop on a merchant ship to get to the Sword Coast,
Yeah.
I think it's a really fun setting, though it might be random.
Yeah,
it seems really cool. I loved the Kraken as like this overlord, underlord, whatever you want to call it. Like just this cool mythos about Krakens. I think they're so much fun. Man, that'd be cool if there were a pre-written for like in that area too that involved a Kraken. Is there a pre-written that involves a Kraken?
I'm sure. That's a great question.
They are. I've done, some reading as I'm running a pirate campaign on Krakens, and it is pretty wild, the lore and everything behind them, and all their ties to the world. But
I love it. I love this setting. Like. Island situation, amazing. I'm glad that we're keeping this like sort of underwater merfolk theme going. I don't know how we all did that today, but I
it was just a nice coincidence.
For months and months.
That I'm definitely here for like the dragon and the kraken and if I'm a player in this campaign, I really feel like I need to know more about I'm going to call it now the KSSN, the Kraken Society Spy Network. I run a beat in the KSSN. Like,
that's incredible.
Absolutely.
I pulled up the Purple Rocks here on Forgotten Realms fandom and maybe you said it there, but did magic is punishable by death in the
show? Yeah. Cool. I love areas that are like that, and I always like the idea like that is so fascinating to think of, like people who are innately born with magic, right, being potentially ostracized or shamed for something like that in that kind of a society.
Burned at the stake, more like.
Yeah that is really cool. There's a lot of things I actually like about this. The purple lichen that gives the rocks their color and the namesake, the area, I think is so cool. I love the concept of plant and local wildlife that is just a little bit strange and non-familiar, but still something that is memorable enough. That's just something I feel like is going to stick with you.
That's what I latched onto as well, because it's not totally alien, where everything else still feels like, this is familiar, I know this, but it's like, oh, the plant life is purple, that's weird,
Yeah.
I love that.
Man, that I did a thing a while ago when I was on Facebook. There was a group that there's a spot in my map called the Red Marshes that I still have no idea why it's called the Red Marshes, but these types of things, the purple rocks, why are they called the purple rocks? Because of the hue that happens at night, that under stormy skies, it adopts this hue. And I was like, wait. But the all that to say, somebody, I put my map on there. I was like, point to a spot and tell me what it's called. And they pointed to it and said, that's called the Red Marshes. I was like, great. Why is it called the Red Marshes? Now I need to come up. And I totally forgot about that, why it's called the Red Marshes. But that made me think of, I need to actually, maybe they're red because of the sun hitting them and it becomes red. Who knows?
You know what? I want, we should do a one shot. We've talked about doing bonus episodes, right? We should do a bonus episode, one shot of just a group of treasure hunters going into the Kraken's lair, because the idea that it is this ancient elven society that got wrecked by the drow and is now reclaimed by the Kraken, that leads me to believe that there are a ton of just hidden gems and jewels, literally and proverbially, in that area. That just sounds like such a cool place.
Yeah, a little bit more on the lore of it's spelled Ascarle. It says it was swept into the ocean by melting glaciers, destroyed by the drow, and again was inhabited by the Kraken society. There's actually, it's not a lot, and again, I want to reference all of this information I got from the Forgotten Realms wiki, yes, where all good things come from. There's not a ton of lore on it, which to me is always more fun, because then you really have the liberty to fill in, and you can still stay true to the lore while saying, well, the details of this aren't documented well. So we can kind of go off script a bit, but.
Yeah, man, that's good stuff. That's fun. It's always, I always love what D&D lore has to offer, because it's always you see it at one thing and then you just start deep diving like we just did, and you're like, oh wait, but this is who took it over, and it just adds to the enjoyment of this world. Gosh, I love that, man. Good stuff. Thanks for doing that, man. We have a segment on the D100 table that we roll at the end of each episode, and last episode we ended by rolling, I forget what the number was, but it was pacing and momentum in combat. So that's what we're going to jump into here. And we're going to follow our initiative order. And looks like, Nicole, you're going first here. How do you handle... We're just jumping right into it. I didn't even ask. We're just jumping right into it, I guess.
How do you roll on high on initiative?
I know. And this is when I get...
I'm here for it. It'll never happen again, so I'm living in it today.
Hey, we've all been there, right? Back at the top of the initiative. Oh,
right, crap. It's been 45 minutes. Another thing is the D20 an initiative system even...
Yeah, right.
Oh, man. How do you handle pacing and momentum in combat at your table, especially with kids? That's got to be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think I probably do it in the most simple shortcut kind of way, because I do mostly play with kids or a mixed group of kids and adults. So my pace in combat is really fast. And usually... Even a big bad battle is not going to take more than 10 minutes max at my table, because kids' attention span, right? They don't actually want to do the same thing for all that long. So, the kind of something that I do that's different than traditional D&D is whenever we're in combat, they really only can do three things. What I usually say is, on your turn in combat, you can do three things. You can talk if you want, for a short amount of time, no monologues, right? But you could talk a little bit. You can do an attack, just an attack, and you can move. And that's it. I don't do bonus actions. The attacks are usually pretty simple. It doesn't get quite as complicated as like adult D&D would with like, oh, you know, I throw magic missile at this target and this target and this target. And let's see what hits. And like, it's a lot simpler process that I do just to like keep the combat moving quick. And really, you know, I guess this is true for adults and kids, but the kids just want to like defeat the thing and move on, right? So I usually make it pretty easy for them to do that within, I don't know, maybe like 3 or 4 rounds at the most, even for a big fight.
So for, you said you don't do bonus actions. Do you have like some spells are bonus actions as spells? How do you handle that in your games?
Well, my players don't have the luxury of access to all of the spells. They really only have what I give them. So like, you know, if I think in our campaign, I think most of the players are like level 3 right now. So they only have 3 spells or attacks to choose from. Mm-hmm. And then oftentimes, you know, kind of in the place of a bonus action, oftentimes they will have some sort of like special ability that they can also do, which sometimes is combat related and sometimes not. Gotcha. But in like, so for example, like a barbarian, right? In traditional D&D, you know, you can like bonus action rage, right? Mm-hmm. Which is great. For sure do that. But like in my game, if you're playing a barbarian, that's more like a special feature of your character, is that if you want to, you can use your turn to turn on your rage, which, you know, basically just means you hit for like double damage or something like that. It's all very like titrated down and simplified.
That's actually kind of sweet though. Like, I kind of just like that. Like, barbarians rage, that's kind of their thing. Like,
yeah.
I kind of wish that were built into it where it's like, yeah, I'm just raging all the time. Like, just deal with it. You know? Man.
I think that's great, though. Keeping it simplified sometimes makes things so much nicer because there's so many options that having less is oftentimes the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something that I've had to learn painting-wise. Like, these has so many different brands of paint. It was like, it's way too much. I ended up giving them away to my friend. And now I only use like 2 brands and I just stick to it. So,
like, too many options get overwhelming, even for adults.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I find myself doing that at work. Man. All right.
Brings us to you, Jeff.
Yeah. So I play a lot of war games too, and I kind of take a mentality from a wargamer mentality into my D&D games a little bit, and I kind of have a shot clock, if you would, where I also we're already like we're level 12 in my campaign. People have 150 health. They're hitting for 60-70 damage. So combat is kind of crazy at that point in my game. So, and I have a couple players that I don't know why, but their spells are like 6 pages long. And so like, they'll be reading things. I'm like, dude, just get to the point. What is happening here on this? Like, yes, I get it. A lot of things, it's a lot of happening with this prismatic orb that is 6 paragraphs long for some reason. And so what I'll actually do is if like outside of reading the spell text and stuff, like if you don't really know what you're going to do on your turn, I have like a minute, 2 minute in real life time to figure it out. Otherwise, you're just going to cast whatever your first cantrip is. Or if you're a melee character, you just hit one. So that keeps combat going. And you still get to do something on your turn, you know, like the characters, the players still get to cast, you know, Eldritch Blast or whatever if they can't figure out what, you know, broken warlock build they're using this time. Like, you know, they they have to figure it out. Two, it keeps the players at my table engaged in the game because they know like, oh, wait, no, I have to like know what I'm doing or I'm just going to fire off, you know, fireball or firebolt. So it's kind of a fun thing for that. And I don't ever skip anybody because that feels bad. But it really sucks when you're at the table and combat's going. You got somebody that wasn't paying attention. Then 10 minutes later, they're like, oh, I think I'm going to finally do this. And everyone is derailed from whatever epic moment was just happening. And that sucks. So I try to keep that down as much as possible by even if you're not paying attention, I guess you're going to cast your basic spell or
some nice trade off to you. Because then, like I said, you don't get skipped, but I always come back to the reality of it is in-game, you have 6 seconds.
Exactly.
You know, your turn is so... Because I've never employed it, but I've even thought about, you know, hey, I don't love using a timer because I don't want to limit people's, you know, ability to think things through. But it's also like, hey, if we're sitting here too long, maybe your character is just having decision paralysis and, you know, you just... don't take action this turn, you know, which I think is valid, but I love that actually as a trade-off of you just do your base ability and then you move past because that's what your character knows, you know.
Because like a lot of times, like in when I'm thinking about it, like in my head, like as a story perspective, you know, like you're, let's take a melee character, you know, you're a paladin, for example, you know, you get stuck into combat. And then in the heat of battle, you get hit by the head or something like that. And you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. And literally in real life, you're like, wait, how do I need to? Because a lot of times you're trying to see, like, how can I do the most of something this turn? And that takes, you know, that's that building in your mind of what, okay, if I chain this with this and this, and if I get this position. But sometimes your character just gets hit on the head and you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. So I just shield bash him. I don't know. Like, I don't know. So I try to like weave it into the storytelling a little bit too. So that's kind of how I handle pacing. But then also too, from a thing that not all combat is violence, like our encounters, like not everything is always smash, smash, spell, spell. Sometimes you have those, you know, verbal encounters too, where, you know, combat or pacing for that side of things, you know, if you have a verbal encounter, trying to let at least get everybody have some sort of like cool, maybe not a monologue, but, you know, a cool moment where they get to try to contribute to something if they'd like to. So, but yeah, that's how I handle that.
Very nice. Very nice. So continuing initiative, a few things I do. One for combat is, I have seen Matt Mercer do this and a few other GMs either do this in actual plays or talk about this. And I really like it, which is whenever I make the initiative order, we've got that all up as a GM. I will be like, okay, now it is so-and-so's turn. Also, you next on deck, you know, making sure to reference and prompt that player that, hey, you're coming up after this is over. And I think that definitely kind of helps keep the players engaged, earning things and knowing, you know, okay, here is the time that I have to be able to prep and get ready. Another thing I do for pacing and momentum in combat is trying to keep my enemies, the big bads, you know, their turns short. I like to incorporate some of their reactions or some of their commentary in response to my players' choices and words and actions. And that way it's a way to kind of highlight their moment in combat without adding and saturating the enemy's moment in combat. And so it keeps it, you know, kind of keeps it broken up and continuing along. And yeah, at the end of the day is, you know, with D&D 5th edition mechanics, which we all tend to rely on for most of our games, it is 6 seconds. That's it. And so I try to also remind my players that throughout, you know, yeah, so like, you know, at the end of like each kind of total initiative order, you know, like, guys, like, you know, all of this, you know, such and such happened, you know, in this short period of time in 6 seconds, you know, and kind of recap sometimes some of those moments or what that looks like. And kind of illustrating that fast pace, I sometimes find helps my players maintain that in the initiative order. And as we go into the next round, if sometimes there's been a lull or someone took a little bit longer. But the other thing I like to do for my players that kind of struggle sometimes in, you know, some combats, they just feel out of it or not on top of it. I try to think of my enemies, you know, what their predatory instincts might be. And I think about, you know, okay, if there is that character on the battlefield who is looking in, that they're in over their head, or that they are distracted, you know, they have other things going on that are keeping them from being focused in this moment. Their heart or their minds are elsewhere, concerned about things. Maybe the enemy does prioritize and go after that person, thinking, oh, here's somebody that's weak. I can take this person out of the chessboard and help, you know, eliminate a threat quickly. And sometimes I find by doing that and shifting the focus then to that player who's struggling, then they go, oh crap. Okay, I need to really double down and, you know, try to put some distance or maybe get engaged, get in a defensive position or be on the offense. And then that kind of gets them re-engaged or motivated to do the most on their turn and get ready for it and think about what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, and I would echo a lot of what Charlie said for what I do too, is wherever I heard it or saw it first, letting your players know who's on deck is, again, has been a game changer at my table of just, I just haven't done it. It's not that I wouldn't. I don't always display the initiative order. You know, we'll announce it, I'll write it all down, but I don't ever have it out there for everyone. Sometimes because that's a surprise monster that, you know, or what, for whatever reason. But letting them know of like, hey, you're up next has been a big deal. With that, it's something I wish that I would employ the use of more. But each round of combat, it's all happening at once. So as a player and even as a DM, sometimes I have a tendency to be like, okay, well, that character did that just now. Well, so that's going to change what this person does, you know, so they're going to move there. Instead of really, that round is all happening at the same time, you know, in the blink of an eye, basically. So making decisions based on what you currently see, or even as a DM describing things of like, while you see this person, you know, slicing this beast or something, you're doing this, you know, and really trying to emphasize like the close, tight time window that all of it is happening in, I find really helps. I have 6 players at level 9, so kind of to echo what Jeff said, it's a lot at level 9, and 6 players is also a big group. So you want to make sure that you're cycling through enough that everybody is staying engaged. And it's something that I'm still kind of exploring to see how it works. But I'm almost like 2 or 3 to 4 rounds of combat is probably like the longest any combat's ever going to last with that many players, especially. And so I'm trying to be more cognizant of, right, maybe these are like glass cannon sort of enemies where they're going to hit hard, but they might only hit once, you know, and that's okay. It's always disappointing, you know, if you take all the time to print or buy the mini and paint it all up for it to, you know, make its appearance and be defeated that quickly. But that's also kind of the point, you know. The other advice that, again, I'm sure I heard, but I now employ is, as a DM, really know and understand the monsters or creatures or individuals that you're throwing at your players. The more you understand, the more you've prepped what their abilities are, what their immunities, you know, defenses and all those things, the easier it's going to be that when it becomes your turn as the DM to move all the monsters on the game board, you're not taking as much time. That to me has been really important to keep things going. Because again, it's challenging to keep things for a large group or high level players. It's hard to keep things engaging and in combat worthwhile of, you know, every once in a while, it is just a lot of fun to steamroll over goblins, you know, but you want to make your players have to stop and think sometimes about what they're fighting and employ tactics and things. So Yeah, it's still something that I think is really challenging. I think it's one of the more challenging things as a DM is keeping pacing in combat sometimes. Because again, I don't want to steal, you know, the player's opportunity to think. But I think I'm going to actually start employing what Jeff was talking about and say, you know, we have this much time. Maybe it's not a hard limit, but like if it's clearly been.
Yeah. And that was just,
you know.
Yeah. And that was just an example. It may be maybe not 2 minutes, but like because a lot of times it's like, oh, well, I want to do this. And of course, you know, then it's like, well, yeah, like then everyone gets involved, like because I'm not a harsh DM. Like I want the players to do cool shit. Like that's why you're there. So I'm like, oh, well, you could do this. You can't do this because of X, Y, and Z mechanically. But I love when all the other players get involved too. Like, oh, well, what if we kind of like it within reason tried to set up this type of thing? It's like, yeah, like see how that works. You know, you're ultimately going to roll a nat one anyways. Like, so
I always kind of gauge with that too, of like, if they're trying to do things in tandem, I always try to gauge like, okay, how well do these two characters actually know each other? They've tried this before. Is this something that they would have in downtime talked about? Like, hey, this would be, you know, maybe we should try this, you know? And sometimes I set the DC higher or lower based on like, all right, no, these two characters have actually interacted a lot and they've fought side by side a lot. Whereas, you know, if I have a, not even a new player, but I mean, in a group of six players, it's likely that two of those characters have really not interacted very much. So if all of a sudden they're going to be the, you know, like be Thor and Loki and do the get help thing, like it might not go as well as two characters that have been, you know, adventuring together and, you know, side by side. It's a lot of a challenge, though.
Yeah.
Pacing in combat is a challenge.
It is. It is. You touched on something that actually I wanted to bring up, too. Like, I struggle with it a lot. We had five players. Now we have four. My brother just went into the military. But I was constantly struggling with either having way too many monsters to fight, or they just would blow through like the one or two that I had. And I still struggle with it too. Like trying to find that nice balance between a glass cannon, you know, versus the horde mentality. But yeah, man, these are all fantastic ways to handle this. And I'm definitely implementing a few of them.
The other thing I wanted to ask was, when you guys have monsters, I tend to, I'll roll initiative, but unless it's like clearly you have the big boss and then all of his minions, sometimes they'll split up their turns. Do you guys just put all of your monsters at, you know, whatever initiative you roll, do you clump them all together or do you spread them out throughout the order?
I have the big boss as my, like, he'll have his own, but then all the little like grots, they all pretty much act on their own. But if it's normally any like type of large encounter that involves a boss like that, there's typically a lair in there too. So I try to, or some sort of like environmental hazard, on, you know, initiative 20. So that's, I normally have at least the main boss go by himself and then, you know, or herself, you know, and then have the grots come do their thing.
I try to call them together. The way my personal rule of thumb is, how different are the mechanics of the enemies? So if the enemies, you know, like if we've got, you know, say five monks that are the enemies, I'll just have them go one after the other, you know. But if you have, a big bad and then a couple lesser guys, but they all have different abilities and different damage types, I will probably do a different separate initiative for each of those because they're doing something distinctly different. But if I can roll the same thing for the same group, then yeah, I'll typically do that just to keep the pacing quick. So sometimes the players get lucky then, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, we, you know, do a roll, you know, for a dexterity save for all five of them, you know, and they either all fail or all succeed.
And sometimes you just roll a four in initiative. So,
yeah. See, I do all my rolls individually, though, still for those, like, even if they act on the same initiative, if they all have to do a save, I'll do a save for individuals.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be the weird one out again because I play D&D, but I play it my own way. And we don't roll initiative in my game for anything. I do monster's turn or enemy's turn, hero's turn. And it's just whatever order. Like when it's the monster's turn, obviously I choose the order. Whatever. It doesn't always have to be the same. And then when it's the team of heroes' turn, they choose the order between themselves. But we don't roll initiative.
So would you keep that from round to round? Like if Bob is going first this round, will Bob always go first? Or it's the monster's turn. Now it's you guys, you each get to. That's kind of awesome though.
Yeah, you get to pick every time. So then like whatever's convenient is kind of what you can do first.
That's kind of cool.
I feel like that probably builds teamwork better too, because then you can kind of be thinking about like, well, if they go before me, they might be able to do this. And then, you know, yeah. I can capitalize on that.
That's cool. I like that thought, actually.
It definitely leads to these really good discussions with the players of like, okay, well, we know he's vulnerable to ice. And like, I have the ice attack, so I'm going to go first because that might actually go ahead and kill him. And then you could focus on the other one. So it's really cool. I like it.
That is super cool. I like that a lot.
We kind of have something like that going on in the game that I'm playing or that I'm DMing right now. We haven't been able to play in a while, but they're in the middle of this like Mad Max style chase. But they're all the players are in one cart and they all have to act on the same initiative. And then they can all do things individually, but they act on whoever is the driver. And then they use that person's stat to steer this, calling it a water skimmer. And they have to do that, but then they get to act on their own, but they're at disadvantage because they're moving so fast. But that's led to these really cool, like, oh, I'm going to cast freeze, or I think it's frost, cone of frost or something like that. That like slows people down. So they're going to do that and then try to hit them with some other things. It's led to some really fun, combos kind of, and it's a nice change of pace from the. You go, okay, I'm going to hit you four times. Does a 32 hit? Okay, cool. I don't know. It's kind of fun. I like these different ways of playing the game.
I think that's the beauty of D&D is you can take the rules that you like and change them when you don't and see what works and see what doesn't and, you know, go from there.
Exactly. And I think that's something that's really cool about this podcast too in particular is all four of us, we all DM or GM differently, and it's really fun to see how, you know, everyone's table is run and what you can take to your table. Yeah. And share with your friends and different things like that.
Absolutely, because there's no right way to, you know, run combat at every table, but there is a right way to run it at your table, and that's
right.
Love that.
Yeah, man. And I don't think there's a better way to end this segment and this episode than that. There isn't a wrong way to play D&D, just the right way at your table. So with that, Charlie, why don't you hit us with the D100 roll since you got us with that wisdom there anyways. Why don't you roll a D100 there?
So last time it was actually 79 that we rolled.
79, that's
what. For pacing, momentum, and confidence. And this time it's going to be... Ooh, okay. If I was a cleric and I was rolling, I would be very happy. This is the 11th. So that is going to be... Okay. Oh, this is going to be a fun one. Favorite Wizards of the Coast D&D setting.
Ooh.
Right on.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Man.
Now... The reason I will say for our listeners, we have a few different things on the D100 about different D&D settings. So we're saying Wizards of the Coast. We understand Wizards of the Coast was not involved in D&D for all 50 years. Shout out to the Gygax group and family and all of them and everyone that was involved prior to Wizards of the Coast, now currently involved. But that does mean your favorite D&D setting for the last 50 years that was... part of the official setting for that. So that is awesome.
That's gonna be a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely gives a lot to think about, that's for sure, man.
That was a fun one. Thank you guys for joining again, as always, and being a part of this podcast. And thank you to you, the listeners, our supporters. The amount of support that we've gotten already, and this is only episode 2, has been insane. And from the bottom of my heart, at least, I can't thank you guys enough. And I'm sure I speak for the rest of everybody else here. So thank you, and we'll catch you in the next one. See ya.